Welcome to Da Vinci's Discourse, where the minds of today's most innovative entrepreneurs are unveiled and explored. And my name is Kyle Campbell, your guide on this journey into the depths of the entrepreneurial psyche. So sit back, relax, and get ready to dive into the minds of the greats. This is Da Vinci's Discourse.
Dude, I'm jealous how cutting edge you are. I'm just at the cusp of like, oh, I'm going to have to do some work if I'm not going to be left behind in all of this, or just have somebody else handle the AI thing for me. So that's awesome.
That's what I do, dude. I'm the marketer end of it. So I just get to be all fascinated and eyes open and just, wow, the kind of stuff that they're able to develop. So yeah, I'm on the same page, man. I got no idea what's coming, but I'm just along for the ride, holding on for dear life, just begging for more and more. Yeah. So it's as exciting as all hell, man. So that's pretty much it, what we're up to. And
cool,
it's only the beginning, so it's interesting to see where it's going to go. So, man, dude, you ready to get into it?
Let's do it. I'm ready.
All right, brother. So, dude, Brad, it's awesome to have you here, man. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself? I'm curious. What do you love about what you do?
Oh, man, that is a multifaceted angle to go down. I mean, obviously, like most entrepreneurs, I love the freedom that comes with being able to just solve the problems that are interesting to me, work with the people that are interesting to me. Like ultimately my entrepreneur journey was a play for freedom, right? I tried the corporate thing. I did public accounting at massive firms. I did Goldman Sachs in the massive plug into, again, awesome problems to solve, but I didn't fit in that box. I think most of us as entrepreneurs realize that. So that's definitely kind of what spurred it. But That's I guess more the more technical part of it. The broader mission driven part of what I like about what we do is, and it's not that I don't value what we do, but like my skills of like spreadsheets and number analysis and tax work and investing to me is all secondary to the real problems I think the world faces that other people are equipped to solve. Like the clients we work with and what they're out on the front lines doing, the fact that I get to make it to where business owners can be more successful in that, I look at it as to be like, I can't solve cancer or help people with these like big world changing problems, but I can help a business owner who has that skill, who doesn't have the business operational side of it down, to be able to go out and do that. Because at the end of the day, entrepreneurs solve problems. Governments don't solve problems. Charities don't solve problems. Now they all help and there's roles for that. But it's truly the entrepreneur that sees a problem, takes responsibility for it, coordinates resources to be able to get that done. So I just look at it as to be like, hey, that's how I look at my little corner of changing the world, is helping the founding level entrepreneur go change the world through being able to run a profitable business.
Right. Okay. So dude, let's say I hired you as a consultant. What's the end goal looking like? Where are we going in terms of the ideal situation?
Yep. So we all started a business, whether we want to admit it to ourselves or not, to get rich, right? We want to make money. Like if we do all of this and take all this risk and spend all this time and don't make money, then what was the point, right? That's not to downplay our other missions, and those have to be there. But if a business doesn't make money, it doesn't exist anymore. And if a business owner doesn't get paid from their efforts, they won't be able to continue to put time, effort, and energy into that business. They'll have to go somewhere else. So ultimately, our goal is to build a bridge between the business and the personal wealth of the entrepreneur. So I want entrepreneurs to become financially, whatever you want to call it, financially free, financially secure, financially independent, even from their business. So that then when they're running their business, they can make the decisions that are most in alignment with what the business needs and not put themselves at risk to the fluctuations, ups and downs of the business. So we're here to get the business owner financially secure, again, even independent of the business. Now that requires a lot, which is why we do taxes, why we do financial analysis, why we do, you know, CFO work. I mean, it's an entire connection, but the end game is for an entrepreneur to have the option, right? Open up options to step away, reinvent themselves, reinvent the business because they're in control of their financial destiny.
To be able to take a sabbatical for say a year and be able to step away and not have their business and finances crumble and fall apart because they were able to set up that foundation ahead of time. And that's what you help folks do. So let's say that I'm an entrepreneur and I'm running a company. Where would we start in terms of helping me build this foundational platform. So that way I'm able to build my finances on it and be able to step away and have these creative journeys away from the business without it falling apart.
Yep. Great question. So I kind of view what I do for most entrepreneurs. It's like your dog needs to take its heartworm medicine, but you have to like force it down its throat. And you're like, this is literally going to save your life, but you won't actually take this. Right. So similar, right. I have to figure out what peanut butter can I put on that pill. Yeah. So like, that's how you get the dog to eat is you know, it'll lick the peanut butter off your hand and eat its heartworm medicine. I have to think about that constantly because most entrepreneurs aren't wired. It's an interesting thing. And it took me a while to discover this because I was wired with the financial part of it, that the skill of making money inside of a business and then keeping that money or growing that money are two completely different skill sets. They both have dollar signs to them, but they're different worlds, right? Yeah. And so to get that, you know, the peanut butter I have to put on the pill to focus on the keeping and growing side of it. So very tactically, the average small business owner that we've encountered with is leaving more than $48,000 a year on the table from an excess payment of taxes that are like they're voluntarily simply because they don't know any better paying $48,000 a year more in taxes. And we know that because we track every single client we work with and the average tax savings of our entry-level client is $48,000 a year. So that's the like, why would I pay attention to you? Where do we start? It's like, why don't we just stop writing Uncle Sam a bigger check than we need to? The real pill that I want business owners to swallow is our real true mission here is to raise the financial IQ of business owners and to get them in a position to where, like, I don't want them to be like, my goal is not to be like, I'll just do whatever Brad says and whatever Brad says works. Like, no, I want you to become empowered or in control and understanding the financial decisions because ultimately it's your business and it's your wealth and you need to know how to end up running that. So the long game is we're going to raise your IQ as we take you through this process. The peanut butter we'll put on the pill is how about we get $48,000 a year back from Uncle Sam. To
love it. I love the peanut butter and the pill analogy, man. It's like, that's marketing in a nutshell. You've got a service or a product and you got to put the peanut butter on it to make it seem magical for somebody to say, wow, that's what I want. And be able to take their wallets out and say, yes, all right, let's do it. Because working with you, if you save them 48 grand a year, instantly without having to change much other than we'll go over a little bit of the changes we can make, but you're talking about having a service that's better than free at that point. And that's what we all aim for as entrepreneurs, an offer that appears and is genuinely better than free. So let's dig into that a little bit, man. Let's say that I'm totally ignorant on paying taxes. I've never done it in my life. It's my first year paying taxes, let's say. How would we go about making sure that I don't overpay? When it comes to that, I started a business, it's profitable. Say I made 250K. Where do I start to make sure that I'm not overpaying?
Yeah, well, we'll have to go back to, you know, in high school when they taught you how a tax return works and how credit cards they didn't teach any of this in high school or college for that matter, right? We were never taught this. So the first distinction to understand, so I've taken, you know, I have a master's of accounting. I took graduate level at a top three university tax courses. First thing to understand is not one of my courses was labeled how to save your clients' taxes. Not one. I have my textbooks over there still on my bookshelf. And there isn't even a chapter inside the textbook that says how to save your client taxes. That is not what CPAs go to study. The entire textbook is if this number is here, this is the box that it needs to go into. It's compliance focused. Okay. Which is completely different than the way we as entrepreneurs think about the world. Yeah. No so kidding. When you talk to an accountant that, again, I like analogies because it helps me understand the world as well. And it makes complex ideas simple. But we as the entrepreneurs are, you know, we're driving a car, we're looking forward and we're trying to get to our destination. But if you ask a CPA advice, it's like blocking the front windshield out and trying to drive the car, just looking in the rearview mirror. Cause that's all the information that they have to work off is what already happened in the past. Right. So the first thing is we have to recognize we are holding our CPAs to a standard that they were not trained to do, nor do they believe it's really their responsibility. And then we're frustrated when we don't get the answer that we want. So first off is we have to find somebody that does tax strategy, not tax compliance. And typically they're actually not people who file taxes. So all of our tax strategy, I don't have I can't file your taxes. I don't want to file your taxes, because we actually want to separate those roles. Because at the end of the day, what a lot of people don't realize is, even though you pay your CPA doesn't work for you. He or she works for the IRS.
The government. Yeah, no kidding.
They're regulated, and their license is regulated and governed by the IRS. So they're limited as far as what they can tell you, what they can open up for you, what they can strategize.
Whereas
so
we need somebody who, right, it's totally different. They're working for you. They're in your corner. They're your coach, as opposed to, it's like in a boxing analogy, you know, it's like you got your coach in your corner, as opposed to listening to the other coach telling you what to do. It's exactly. Like you're going to listen to the other team's coach when he's countering everything with
everything that you're doing. And they're actually limited as far as what they can proactively tell you. So if you want that proactive forward thinking, driving the car forward, we've got to get a tax strategist on our team that is going to connect the dots and say, hey, if you do this, then your CPA can help you take the deduction, right? Mm. And that's how we get over the thing of like, oh, my CPA said I couldn't XYZ. Well, that's only because you didn't already do it in the past. That doesn't mean you can't do it tomorrow and then claim the deduction. So that's where we come in, is we line out the most common low-hanging fruit, missing elements of tax strategy that CPAs don't let you know about. We have six strategies that save an average, I mean, we've saved as much as six figures in taxes, but again, that $48,000 number is, we'll come and we'll do those. That's low hanging fruit. We put that in place. Cool part about it, it doesn't require foreign entities or Cook Island trusts or any of this complex stuff that you would assume. It's actually all very, very basic that, again, we can put in place in a matter of less than 90 days and have it up and running.
Wow. So you got six strategies. What's the most impactful one? I want to walk through and say exactly what somebody can do tactically speaking to immediately drop their tax bill and be able to save money. And then how do they work with you to get the other five? That's what I'm talking about, baby. So we'll go into the most impactful one because I'm fascinated by it.
So the most common one we see is just a misunderstanding. So we want, what the first thing we come in and put in place is what we call a holding corporation. If we don't have a business holding corporation in place, then we're going to pay half of our tax savings comes from people who don't know how to use a holding corporation and thus pay too much in self-employment tax. And that's before we even talk about income tax. This is just self-employment tax, because as a business owner, you're paying both sides. So you're paying over 15% just on employment tax before we even go to the income tax side. And the reason why a holding company is important is it is able to control and buffer how we end up taking income. So when you hear about millionaires and billionaires, right, they don't work for the companies they own, right? Berkshire Hathaway, right? It's a holding corporation that owns all of the corporations underneath it. And that's why they pay a different style or amount of tax. It's not as simple as there's one tax that we all pay. There's actually three separate tax codes. And by putting a holding company in place, we're able to take advantage of an entirely different tax code. And that actually then opens up the other strategies below it. So it's twofold. Without that holding corp, we can't do the other strategies. And we're usually doubling up or more our employment tax. So that's step one, is implementing a holding corporation to then own all of our various business interests, consolidate them into one management entity, and then run from there.
Okay, so let's say I'm totally ignorant on all of this. Let's say I don't have a holding corporation, and let's say that I'm getting into it for the first time. Where do I start to be able to formulate this structure of company? And then what are some of the things that we can move downstream in terms of leveraging that structure?
Yep, and that's the hardest part about this is definitely not one of those DIY, go try it yourself, because probably screw it up, right? Yeah. So again, it's back to that idea of don't go ask your CPA and don't go ask your attorney, because again, they're going to come at it from their angles. So you need to find a business strategist or a tax strategist that will come in and be able to form that for you. And then put that in place. It's not something I recommend you go, again, do it yourself, because there's legal, transfers of ownership of the entities. We have to file a very specific paperwork with the IRS and ensure that it's done properly and then it's done. So really, this is a who, not how question to be answered, especially for the business owner, right? It's find the right who, they'll take care of the how. And like I said, a $48,000 return on a very small fee to have somebody else pay for this is the best return that you're ever going to get. So maybe the better question that I think we get here is, when does this become necessary, right? Am I too early to be able to do this? What's amazing in this tax world that we live in, if your business is making even just right around $100,000 a year, then you're paying at least $20,000 to $25,000 more in tax than you need to if you don't have these strategies. And when I say $100,000, that's like before paying you your own income. So it's not your income plus $100,000. If you're taking $75,000 to $100,000 out of the business for your lifestyle in any form, then this strategy is going to pay dividends, at least a five-figure return on putting all of this together. If you're not making quite that amount, my answer is get to work on growing your business and essentially just all of your time, effort, energy, money out, and just be focused on getting yourself. Because if you're not making $100,000, you know, it's too easy in America to not make $100,000.
Right. There are better places to be focusing your time. But once you get to the $100,000, let's say $100,000, $250K, somewhere around there. What do I do to tactically get this corporation or get this holding company in place? And then how do I go about managing my money in the bank account itself? So that way I'm not paying personal income tax, and how do we expand it from there?
Yep. So we're going to get a little tactical, if that's okay for your listeners. Yeah, we'll roll up our sleeves. So what we want to do is all of our operating businesses need to just be LLCs. They shouldn't be C corporations. They shouldn't be S corporations. They should just be LLCs. Whether you have a business partner or not, it doesn't matter. They should all just be the most basic form of entity. Then you're going to put your holding company will own all of those. So I own four separate businesses. I mean, I own several more entities than that, but as far as like established businesses with payroll and expenses and revenue streams and all of that, I own four separate businesses. But me, Brad Gibb, I don't own a single one of them. My holding corporation owns all of them. And then I have business partners in those, and their holding companies own those as well, right? So it's corporations own corporations.
Yeah, it stacks up. Interesting.
But then that holding company is owned by me. That's what I own.
Yes.
And that holding company needs to be your S corporation. And with that S corporation designation at that level, now I'm in control of the income that is distributed to me, the nature of the income that is distributed to me, whether it's salaries or whether it's dividends, right? And think about this side of it, like, you know, ExxonMobil. I could work for ExxonMobil or I could own ExxonMobil. I get paid either way. But if I work for ExxonMobil, I earn wages, which are subject to self-employment taxes. But if I own ExxonMobil, I'm now not earning a wage. I don't have to pay self-employment tax, and I can pay lower tax rates based on that. The S corporation allows us to make that distinction. And I will no longer work for my company. I don't work for any of my companies, but I own them. And so I receive the income as an owner, which is always preferred in our tax situation. So that's the structure, is I only own one corporation, which holds everything else. And then that positions me to change the nature of my income, not have it taxed as wages. And then second, that holding corporation, because its business purpose is no longer, let's say I'm a plumber, right? And if I run everything through a plumbing company, but then I heard that, you know, you can pay your kids to work for you and use that as a write-off. Absolutely true. You can, but it's not ordinary or necessary that a plumbing bit, like, what am I going to have them do in my plumbing business, right? I might not be able to hire my five-year-old in my plumbing business, right? But if now I have a business holding company that owns a plumbing business, and the purpose of that is to build my own personal brand, because eventually I want to be a speaker on stage or do whatever, write a book. Now part of my brand becomes, I want people to know that I'm a family guy and elicit trust in the marketplace that, you know, I'm a family friendly brand. Now, it might sound weird, and we're getting into the next layer of tax strategies, but are there other companies out there that hire five-year-olds in their marketing? Of course, Target does all the time. They have to have cute five-year-olds to put their clothes on to take pictures, so you'll go buy them for your five-year-old, right? So there are other companies that hire kids as models all the time, totally normal. So now my holding company has a social media account, and I put pictures of me and my family on there so that I can gain trust with them. Because if I didn't have a five-year-old, I would have to go hire a five-year-old to make sure that everybody knew that I was family friendly. So now, instead of my kid having to fit pipes as a plumber, which he can't do as a five-year-old, he's now a model for my social media and marketing arm of my business empire. And now I can pay my five-year-old as a model and write them off, right? Super easy, but I had to change the nature of what I was doing. And this is the type of thinking and work that your CPA can't do, because he's just dealing with what he has in front of him.
Dude, Okay, so let's break that down a little bit, because you're talking about, okay, like seriously, wow. So you start with forming the LLC. The LLC is what holds the company that you're, wrong terminology for this example. The LLC is the container that, that your company runs under. But then there's the S corp that holds the LLC, right? And so you can have multiple LLCs within the S corp. Yep. And when it comes to marketing your company, you talked about marketing the S corp, because then you can get tax advantages by having, like, let's say the 5-year-old example. So you're always marketing, because, like, let's say I've got 3 AI companies. There are going to be 3 different target audiences, 3 different services, 3 different opportunities to market this, these 3 different services. Am I marketing, how would you recommend somebody who has multiple companies market? But are they marketing each LLC within the S corp, or is social media the S corp and they're marketing individually the LLCs within?
Yeah, good question. Hopefully this isn't too boring for everybody listening, but we find that
I don't think people... it is, man. Saving 48 grand this year. Come on, baby.
I love this stuff. So I have a life insurance business. I have an investment management business. I have a coaching business, right? Yeah. They all need to do their own marketing. I will hire marketing specialists to click and point in, you know, InstaFace accounts and run all of that stuff that I don't know anything about, right? But I don't work for those companies. I own them, right? So me, as my personal brand, I need to be branded. So I need my own website, and my holding company needs that. And so when somebody says, who is Brad Gibb? Oh, I'm the owner of these, in your case, these 3 AI companies. I'm also a speaker. I'm an author. I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm all these things, right? So now, each company is going to run their own marketing that they need to, but what those companies pay me for is to bring the personal branding to it. So those companies pay me because I own them for that, but then I get to myself, independent of those companies, write off all of the personal branding that I spend time, effort, and energy on at my holding company level. So in order for you to know about me, I need to go get family pictures taken. I need a website. I need some of this basic stuff in place. So like my 15-year-old daughter, she runs my personal Facebook page. And so she's now a social media manager, and I pay her to do that. And I pay my kids to be models and all of that. So that all happens at the company level, because the brand is my personal brand. I mean, think how valuable Elon Musk is to Tesla. Super valuable, even though they're separate entities, right? If you want to think about it that way, right? Yeah. So everything Elon does himself personally is for his own business brand at the holding company level. And then Tesla markets cars on its own. So that's some of that distinction.
Right. Okay. So I've created the S corp. I'm marketing myself personally on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. And I've got the corporations, the LLCs within the S corp. How do I go about actually structuring this? Tactically speaking, I go to a tax specialist, not an accountant, and are able to formulate these corporations and then have the S corp that encapsulates them all.
Yep. Then, so what we do for a client is we put this together. We determine the entity type. We'll actually form the entity. We'll transfer title. We'll file everything with the IRS, and then we'll hand the packet back to their tax preparer. And then the tax preparer is like, oh, this is wonderful. I know exactly what to do with everything inside of this, right? And then same thing, there is documentation and recording, you know, required for this. So to know that you have the right person you're working with to be able to do this, they should bring all those solutions. So for you, if you said, hey, I have 2 kids, I have 3 AI companies, we'd be great. We'd form the holding company, change the ownership of those to be you, and everything flows through, file all that with the IRS. And then we would actually create the employment agreements, because you have to have it. You can't hire somebody without an employment agreement. It's not legitimate, even if it's your own kid. So we'll put the employment agreement together. We'll put their job description together, and we'll create that data, you know, that packet, so that if you were ever audited, the IRS has documentation to look at. We do a wage justification for it. And then again, we hand all that to your CPA, and the CPA says, oh, this looks like just like every other company that I work with that has employment agreements for all their employees and pays payroll for all that. We set it up to run exactly like a corporation. It's just the corporation of you instead of your AI company. And if we live by the adage that if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and looks like a duck, it gets taxed like a duck. So we make run like a corporation, and then you look exactly the way everything needs to be. We're following all of that. And we put it all in place. So we're a done for you service where we'll just come in, we'll do the assessment, we'll put it all together. And then we're training you of which bank account to spend money out of, where to put certain expenses, how money flows through so that you stay compliant. And then we're the buffer between you and the, you know, whoever is filing your taxes.
How do you get in touch with you and your company?
You can. We're still a very high touch, you know, personalized service. So in order to work with us, we got to sit down and see what we're working with, right? It's very hard to be like, hey, if you fit this, like everybody's different.
Yeah.
So you can actually just email me directly, Brad@SovereignEntrepreneur. I know it's two French words together with lots of E's and I's, but
true.
The reason behind it, right? But SovereignEntrepreneur.com is how to get in touch with us. And obviously I don't look at my own email. So my EA will hop in there. We'll send you an intake form, see if you're a good fit to hop on the phone, and then work with us. If you're not a good fit, we promise to make it worth your time to where we'll send you a bunch of sort of do-it-yourself resources to get you started so that you don't make all the mistakes that we spend. You know, people pay us a lot of good money to undo all the prior mistakes before we can even start doing it correctly. So either way, we'll get you some resources to where you can sort of orient yourself and figure out where you're at. And then if you kind of meet some of our criteria, which again are not as high as you might think, we're not building wealth is interesting because Wall Street has trained you to believe that until you have money, they can't manage it for you.
Bernie Madoff.
Exactly.
I don't want your money. We won't take it.
But the problem is we want to work with clients who are trying to create the wealth, not have their wealth managed.
Right.
And that's a very like misunderstanding totally difference that a lot of people. Yeah. So you don't have to have wealth for us to help you create. That's like saying I'm going to lose a bunch of weight before I go to the gym.
True.
Like, no, we need to go to the gym in order to lose weight. So we're here to help build wealth. And the only thing we need is a business owner with a business that's profitable. If we have the greatest wealth creation asset on the planet is a business that you run. Like hands down, businesses create more wealth than any investment, than any third, than anything else. And so if we have that, we have all the tools we need to drive profitability, save taxes, secure those profits, and then ultimately turn it into wealth on the back end, which we bring to the table as well. We're tip to tail, full service on that. But we spend the investing is the easy part. Growing and running a business is the hard part.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why you said focus on the 100 grand first before you move into your services.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
The profit first. Okay. So how do, this is my question because I'm buying a house right now. How do I go about giving the cash to the bank for the down payment from my, I mean, like, how does that work from, cause you gotta remember, totally ignorant in this. I mean, like we're entrepreneurs, baby. We got no interest in this stuff. We're not wired the way you are, man. So I'm interested. How do I go about buying a house? How do I go about spending the money when it comes to not paying, you know, personal income tax on it, as opposed to the other options? How do I buy the house?
So now that you have your holding company set up and you're no longer a plumber, you are a business conglomerate titan like Warren Buffett, right? So now anything that Warren Buffett would write off, you can now write off. So we're going to take all the things in your personal life and push as many of them down to the business level as possible. So my wife and I are going to New Zealand in a couple of weeks. That is a business trip because we're going to go work at international relations for potentially expanding there. While we sightsee, she's on my board for my company. And so we're going to do annual planning, right? And before you get too cynical about this, how many of you have ever either A, gone on vacation or B, gone to dinner with your spouse and not talked about business? Like, I dare you to not do it, right? We all do.
True. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So we're just going to now make that legitimately a business trip. And I don't have to change my plans at all. I just have to look like a duck, walk like a duck, and talk like a duck, and just organize the business conversations that we're going to have and create a business purpose for it. So my entire trip to New Zealand is going to be written off in my business. Uncle Sam's going to pick up 30 to 40% of the bill for that. And again, there's several other things like that, that we're going to, again, you see millionaires and billionaires doing this. It's not a secret. It's the same tax code. We're just now going to apply it at your level because there's no threshold. Whether it's $1 or $1 million, the tax code's the same. We just have to be able to go through the effort. So that's one element that we're going to do of it. But then specific to your question, your personal home is one that there's actually more tax advantage to owning that as an individual because the government subsidizes through some personal taxation stuff. So we don't buy personal residences in your business. You're going to own that as an individual because you can already write off all of that expense, and it has a bigger impact than doing so inside your business.
Hey, I hope you're enjoying the podcast, and I want to let you know that I've got a free book that you can get if you want to tap into more of these resources, and you can get that for free at kylesbook.com. Back to the podcast.
But if we bought second homes or rental property or office buildings or things, we're going to do that inside of a business structure to be able to do that there. So for your personal residence, the curveball I will throw you is, yeah, you buy it personally, but the best way, again, cash flow, you know, able to manage this is when we're buying real estate of any kind, we want to use as much debt as possible, put the least amount of our own money into it, because leverage becomes the key to building wealth. And if we're structured properly, we want, I mean, we hear this all the time, but then we self-sabotage, right? We hear the famous Rockefeller quote of own nothing and control everything. Well, most people think he did that through trusts and entities and stuff. Most of it was done through debt. Is I don't care if the bank owns my stuff, I just want to control it because I can then build wealth off of it. So that'd be the curveball, is smallest down payment possible, longest loan term possible, fix your interest rate and let inflation make that debt worthless down the road, and you keep your money and you build your business or build investments and create, you'll exponentially increase the rate at which you'll grow wealth than by following the traditional Dave Ramsey approach of pay all your debt off,
right?
Yeah, live below your means. Like, I hate the phrase live below your means. Mine is spend less than you make. That's the only qualification I have. Then I can just go make more money if I want to, right? Rather than arbitrarily fix, this is how much money I make and I have to live below it.
Right. And that caps you as an entrepreneur, right? Because it kind of puts you into a bottle. It's like putting a pumpkin that's just started to grow into a jar and wondering why the hell it doesn't grow past the jar. You know what I mean? It ends up as a pumpkin shaped like a jar. And you're kind of doing that when you look at things the Dave Ramsey way. I know. I see your frustration with that, dude. Now you say to buy it with a fixed interest rate. I was buying it with a variable interest rate because of where the interest rates are at right now. So you think I should buy it even at that current market stage?
My standard advice across to everybody, right, without knowing more about it, is we always want to fix the interest rate, because that becomes a one-way option that you control, right? If I fix the rate now and rates go up, I stay where I'm at and my rate doesn't follow. But if rates go down, I can always refinance and get the lower rate. So I can always chase rates down, but I can cap it of going up. And the delta, the difference between a fixed and a variable rate, is economic risk wise is not worth the payoff, because we always can take advantage of the lower rate later on if we want to. But if we're in, like, you know, most of my clients were fixed, but I have a lot of people coming to me now that it felt like it was a good idea to put their house onto a HELOC and run all their expenses through and try to pay their house off as quickly as possible. Well, if they didn't quite get it paid off, they now went from a 3% HELOC. I was just on with somebody today that has an 11% HELOC. Jesus. Where I was like, well, A, why do I want to pay my house off anyway? But B, I would have been much better off controlling that 30-year fixed loan. My 30-year fixed loan on the house I'm in right now is still 3.25%, right? Because I chased it all the way to the bottom, and now I don't have to change it the other direction. So when we're utilizing leverage for wealth creation, it's important. Have you ever seen the Ghostbusters movie where they're shooting the ghosts and they're like, don't cross the streams of those guns, right? Like, that was the cardinal rule. Same with interest rates. We don't ever take out short-term financing for long-term assets. We always match the term of debt to the length of asset. If I'm financing inventory for my business, I can use short-term because that inventory is going to be gone, right? And then I can get a benefit from a lower rate on something that's variable. But if I'm buying a house that's a 30-year asset that has that life to it, I want to match the debt to it.
Now, couldn't I argue the other way when it comes down to still refinancing it when it gets lower, but then also you're not having the risk of it getting so low that you when it goes down, I can still refinance it the same way as if it was fixed, right?
But if you start variable and it goes up, your rate's going to go up and you're going to be forced to pay more.
Right.
Okay. And that's what
that's more
detrimental than being half a point or a point higher by taking a fixed rate over a teaser variable rate. There's more risk in, if the rate goes up, there's nothing you can do to bring it back down. But if you fix at this and the rate immediately goes down, you can just refinance it and take advantage of it. So we never give away the ability to go lower as rates go lower. But, and this is, this actually ties into a concept that's hard for a lot of us to really understand, that fill in the blank for me. If you want to get a higher return, you must take more
risk.
An absolute lie. It's not true. It's absolutely not true.
You just proved it, right?
What we actually want to do is, if we can eliminate risk, we can actually then generate returns. And the wealthy know this. The wealthy don't take risk. They systematically eliminate
the risk. Interesting.
And you get paid in proportion to how much risk you eliminate. Let's go back to the marketing example. Okay. Nobody just is like, hey, I'm going to spend $10,000 on Facebook ads and hope, see what happens. No, that's risky behavior.
Yeah.
Instead, we try very small campaigns. We figure out where conversion rates are. We figure out what the cost to acquire a client is. And then once the numbers make sense, then we go big on it.
Yes.
But that's not risky, because we already did the work to reduce the amount of risk that we're taking on.
Right.
So we do that in the business world, but then mostly because Wall Street is lying to us about what investing actually is. When we're giving Wall Street money, we're gambling. We're not actually investing. But if we learn to truly invest, if that's the other side of it, is we get paid in proportion to the amount of risk we eliminate. True in business, true in the investing world.
Okay, man. Call my mortgage specialist, being like, dude, I can refinance when it gets lower, but if it goes higher on a variable rate, then I'm screwed. So I'll go into it, because I'm curious. But I want to go into the actual withdrawing of the cash, of the capital in the companies and the LLCs that are earning money, you know, producing pears on their pear trees. I don't know where the freaking example came from. You know what
that's
I mean?
That's good.
You got a forest of fruit that's being grown. How do I go about harvesting that fruit so I can take it to the vendor and say, hey, take my pears so I can buy some shoes, you know? How do I do that?
Yeah, so step number one is get the business, justify as much of your lifestyle as a business expense as absolutely possible, right? The reason why Grant Cardone puts Cardone on the back of his plane is so that he can make it a write-off. He can take it wherever he wants, but it's a business expense now, even though it's moving him place to place, right? So we want to justify my New Zealand trip. I was going to go to New Zealand anyway. If I can make a business reason to go there, I now write it off. So step number one is have the business pay for as much as absolutely possible.
Yeah.
And then step number two is, rather than take income, this is back to, if you've ever read Rich Dad Poor Dad, this is what Kiyosaki talks about, but it's hard to bridge this gap in execution, because the book was conceptual, not tactical. But now what we want is, we want the businesses to then buy assets. So preferably, rather than taking income from the business, because we live in an income tax society, we want the businesses to buy assets and then have the assets give us income, because asset income is taxed completely differently than business or ordinary income. So we want the business to pay as much of our lifestyle as possible. And obviously there's a transition point, because we can't do this day one, but we take profits, buy assets, and then eventually our assets are what fund our lifestyle. This is why, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and those guys pay less than, you know, 10%, sometimes 1% in tax. That's when you factor in their total increase in wealth. Their income tax rate, if you really break their tax return down, their effective income tax rate from what they get paid to run their businesses is the same as everybody else. It's 20, 25%. But because they had their businesses turn into assets, for them it was public companies, but for you, it could be real estate. It could be your company. But then as our assets grow in value, we don't pay tax on that. So Elon's net worth skyrocketed, but he only had to pay tax on his income, not his wealth. So we want to shift and use the businesses not to live extravagant lifestyles, but we want them to buy assets for us, thus increasing our wealth, and we don't pay a wealth tax. And then we use the wealth that our assets create to then fund our lifestyle. It's like my effective tax rate last year was 6%.
No kidding. Wow.
But I'm not poor. But it's because the majority of my lifestyle comes from wealth, not income. And that's the missing key, is we've got to use our business to build assets to produce income.
Now, do the businesses hold the assets? Because what if my LLC gets sued and I've got real estate that's tied to that business? Do I form an LLC with the S corp and then hold the real estate within the LLC within the S corp?
Yeah. So remember the whole Donald Trump fiasco of not disclosing his tax returns and not paying any income tax. Right. You have $700 federal income tax, all that kind of a thing. Well, it's because Donald Trump owns casinos. The casino is a great example. There are two assets in the casino. There is the actual casino operations, right? The slot machines and all of that. And then there's the actual building that the casino is housed in, the hotel. Those are actually separated. The business doesn't actually own any assets, but the hotel is in its own business and the casino leases all of that from it. So now Donald Trump has changed all of that, you know, that business income over to real estate income. And then we get all the depreciation write-offs. That's how he actually did it, to then be able to take that income out. So we actually mirror this active holding company structure with a real estate structure behind it, structured exactly the same. We have a real estate holding company, and then every piece of real estate we want to protect, we put in separate LLCs, and then we lease across, thus shifting income active to passive, and then flowing that up through at tax advantage or even tax-free rate.
Man, it's a game, dude.
It's a shell game. It's Monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. You're finding the ways to work the inner workings there, and you're doing a crazy good job of it. 6% last year. That's cool as shit, man. It's because you know the media will tell us, they'll feed us the stories, and the schmucks in the public, including me, have no friggin' idea what the hell they're talking about in terms of how he didn't pay taxes or whatever. Right? There's a total misunderstanding in terms of the way that it's actually
misunderstanding
internally. Yes,
and it's not a misunderstanding. It's intentional, right? Elicit, you know, certain responses to it.
True. Yeah.
But
fair enough.
What's misunderstood is we feel like this is unapproachable. It's not. The tax code applies to everybody equally, which is what's great about this. It's just nobody has gone after, like, what I'm passionate about is nobody's gone after, like, this founding level entrepreneur that has started a business, you know, bootstrapped it, blood, sweat, and tears to get it to where it's making 100 to 250 to 300,000 and wanting to grow beyond that is completely forgotten about. Like, if you pulled a random 100 people off the street, how many of them started their own business successfully?
Successfully is a different story. Yeah. Maybe a couple of percent if you're lucky. Yeah.
So what gets missed in the world of wealth is financial advice is the same as any other product. If you're going to start a new business and launch a new product, the very first thing you ask is, who is going to buy this from me? That's the first thing you ask. And you make a product for them. Well, if only one, two, or three of us out of 100 are small business owners, is Wall Street going to worry about making a product for us?
Yeah, fair enough.
No, they're going to make it for the other 97 people who are W-2 employees, right? And so all of financial advice is created for W-2 employees. Are our accountants going to worry about us? No, because they're going to go after the other 97 people who need tax returns filed, who are employees. So accounting, legal, financial advice, it's all aimed at the 97 who are not us.
No kidding. Yeah, it makes it tricky, dude. And then it kind of breeds, again, there's an inborn hatred to it because there's a misunderstanding in terms of how it's marketed to us, right? It's a marketing game at the end of the day. Marketing, I look at it as education. We're missing the marketing in terms of how to if there's a company marketing to the 3%, which I'm sure there are, but it's just, we're not getting the same education, right?
Yep. So here's what a business owner needs to be able to work this out. So if you want, like, and I had to learn this as I came into business, as I tried to learn the whole marketing thing, right? Like, I was like, okay, cool. I need to run ads and I need a copywriter and I need somebody to build a funnel and a website and do all this kind of stuff. And pretty soon I was very, very quickly overwhelmed because I had to manage all of those people and make decisions, ensure the strategy all lined up to get effective marketing while still running my business. And then someone came along and said, Brad, you're an idiot. You're doing this wrong. There's this thing called a chief marketing officer. You hire that person and they hire the copywriter and manage the Facebook ad team and build the funnels and all of that. And you just have to talk to one person. I was like, oh, my life just got infinitely simpler. And now I could actually scale my business because I eliminated that contact point. Well, on the financial side, we have the same problem. You have to talk to your accountant and your bookkeeper and your tax preparer and your insurance professional and your attorney and your investment advisor. And you're now monkey in the middle and you can't keep this all going. Well, what's needed for especially this founding level entrepreneur is they need a chief wealth officer.
A chief wealth officer. Interesting. Okay. So that's essentially the tax specialist, but you've internalized it into the company.
But it's more than that. It's also understanding somebody that can talk to your accountant in your business and make sure you get usable business intelligence data. They have to be able to talk to your CPA. They have to be able to talk to your insurance professional. They have to be able to talk to your attorney and make sure you have that in place. They have to be able to talk and then understand what you're doing with your investment side. And if you could collapse, just like you did with marketing, if you could collapse all of your wealth specialists to one person who then ensures you have the right team members all running the right strategy, now your wealth becomes scalable. Most business owners can't scale their wealth because they're trying to do it the monkey in the middle way. So it isn't, I need a better CPA, or I need a better attorney, or I need a better investment XYZ. It's you need to simplify the scale of what your wealth is. And the only way to do that is by hiring a chief wealth officer. But right. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist. Well, it's the one problem that if you solved would solve 1,000 problems, right? So it's like getting better sleep at night. There's the one thing you can do that has an exponential return on it. I'm still curious though. Like, let's say that, okay, the personal house is, even if I have an office in it, that's not I'm still buying that in my name. That will give me
The business rents the office and writes that off. So that's another one of the 6 strategies where, where I get a business write-off for that, but I don't have to claim the income on the personal side.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting little tactic, man. I feel like you got a wealth of these tactics that we could dig into
my house cleaner, my snow removal, my pest control, my lawn care, all of that is for my home office. And so what was a personal expense to outsource all of that stuff is now for the home office that's inside of my house. So that's all now a business expense. A portion of my mortgage, like a portion of my homeowner's insurance, is I can now write it off. My entire internet bill, my cell phone bill, a lot of the furniture that I can buy, my computer, all of that is now a home office. But remember, back to the plumbing example, if my plumbing office, if I have a building for that or an office location that I run that business out of, well, I can't do my home and that one. So again, the holding company is housed out of my house and I work for that company. I don't work for the plumbing company. So when I go to work to the plumbing company, I'm a contractor going to that company. Now I can write off everything for my house and keep it separate from the plumbing company that I then go to work at as a contractor.
So you're contracting yourself as a, even though you're the owner of the company, you contract yourself for the tax purposes.
But I'm technically not the owner of the company, my holding
company. Because your holding company is, yes. Dude, it's a fucking game. It's so
it
funny
is.
When you talk about it like this. Like, wow.
It's ludicrous.
You know how to win the game, but we never learned how to win the game. And that's the problem. That's where you come in with the rest of the 6 tactics. Now, let's say I buy an investment property with the income from, because this is my plan, is to use real estate to grow the wealth. So I buy, like, let's say a duplex, right? Let's say I live in half of it and I'm renting the other half out. Do I still do that as a personal under my name, or do I do that under the real estate LLC?
So real estate's a funny thing. So the government is very adamant about subsidizing the American dream, and that involves buying real estate. So any real estate that is 4 or less units, the government will subsidize the purchase of it through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mortgages. So what you're actually allowed to do, though, is the asset of real estate, the title to that property, is separate and distinct from the financing on that. So to make this make sense, rewind the clock to 2008. That was actually fundamentally a debt crisis, not a real estate crisis. It then changed into real estate. And the reason why is Wall Street took mortgages, they stripped them from the property, and then they actually split the mortgages up even into just the principal portion, the interest portion, in the first 5 years, and the second 5 years. Like, they sliced and diced these into mortgage-backed securities, and that's what ended up contagion exploding into creating all of this. Now, what happens is, if you buy a duplex, you are going to go get the loan from the government as an individual because they'll subsidize it to you and they won't a business. But then we're going to strip the asset and move title of the property over to inside of your business structure so that we still get, absolutely you can.
Wow. All right. Interesting.
So we're now going to play the same games the investment bankers are playing with mortgages and slicing and dicing, all of that. So we still get all the business benefit of owning the real estate. We get the subsidy from the government in subsidized mortgages. Now, if we buy units of more than four units, we're not eligible for that. We got to go to normal commercial financing. And then we just do all of that in the business name.
Okay, so do I play it like Trump and have each building, in this case, at a much smaller scale as an LLC, and then there's an S-Corp that holds all of the buildings? But what about the personal brand? Is there an S-Corp that stacks on top of the S-Corp?
So I have two personal brands. One that is the business entities that I'm running. One is the real estate that I'm running.
Okay.
Now, one just quick minor thing in case somebody technical is listening in. The ownership of the real estate, we don't want to be an S-Corporation. We just want it to be a partnership. So we have one S corporation, and then the other side, because real estate is never taxed as, or we don't have to strip the ExxonMobil of like labor and wages from the other. So we don't want to force an S corp on that technicality, but just to be clear. So, but Brad Gibb only owns two businesses, my active holding company and my passive real estate holding company that owns everything else that I do.
Like a tree, just like the branches off into oblivion, man. So we've gone through a lot here. Leave us with one more of the six strategies. One of the things that we can do immediately to save money on this year's tax paying.
Okay, so we covered holding company to eliminate reduce our self-employment tax. We covered paying your kids on how to do that. We already covered using your home office to stack a bunch of personal expenses into there. We actually already covered the shareholder trip as well. So I'll just clarify that one. So my trip to New Zealand is no longer a vacation to New Zealand. So remember, think about this. Remember, the only written in law justification for whether you can write something off or not, the only standard the IRS holds it to is it ordinary and necessary. Ordinary meaning, do other businesses like you spend money on that thing? And then is it necessary to drive profit, the business operations? So think about this, the biggest sales organizations, like life insurance sales, right? They regularly send their top producers on extravagant trips to reward them for, so it's ordinary and it's necessary because that's a recruitment tool for them. So they are able to write that off. Right. Well, guess what my active company does? Guess who's the top salesman in my company? Me. And the company sends me on an amazing, sales reward trip every single year. This year we're going to New Zealand. So that's no longer a family vacation. It's that trip, right? Or is it also ordinary and necessary that the board of directors of big public companies pick exotic locations to go fly to and do their corporate planning?
Yeah. It's funny that the two criterion that they use to justify whether it's tax deductible or not is completely subjective. I mean, ordinary, they're both debatable. Ordinary, come on, you could debate both of them for no matter what you're doing. You could say ordinary for who, when, at what time period, how.
And this is why you shouldn't ask your accountant's advice, because they're looking at it through the rearview mirror of what was ordinary necessary for you last year.
For you personally, yes.
Mm. And so what we do here is we live by the adage of, if you want to change your tax, you have to change your facts. So we're going to change the facts of the situation to make it ordinary and necessary for you to now write these things off. Oh, if you don't have a holding company, it's not ordinary and necessary to go to an exotic location and do your corporate planning because you're a plumber. It's not ordinary and necessary for plumbers to do that. Yes. But business holding companies do. We change the facts, so now we can change your tax.
What's one more, man? Leave us with one more before we go. We went through those.
So shareholder trip. So I think we covered them. We covered holding company, pay your kids, rent your house from yourself. So I'll clarify this one because we just touched on it.
Okay.
So the tax code is, let me simplify the tax code for you. There's well over 10,000 pages in the tax code, but there's only about a dozen pages to tell you how much tax you have to pay. It basically says, if you make this much of income, here's what you pay and here are all the tables. I mean, really the tax code is everything you make is taxable and here's the tables. Well, then what are the other 9,990 pages for? Well, those are all the ways to save taxes. So the tax code is actually a treasure map. We want to be really good friends with the tax code because it is all of the ways to not pay taxes. Okay. So there's some gems in there that we utilize. One is called the Augusta rule. So, and this is named after, as you might think, the Augusta golf course. This is where it all came from. So the Augusta golf course, destination for golfing, everybody that lived on it did not want to be there when the Augusta golf tournament was happening because the place was overrun. So they started renting their house to people that were coming to the golf course, and they were taking off, and they were renting it for like $10,000 a night. And of course, they didn't report any of that as income because it's their personal house. They're not in the business of renting their thing. The IRS isn't dumb. So they just looked at everybody that lives on there and audited all of them in the same year and said, you all owe a bunch of tax. So big court battles ensued. And the conclusion that was come to, a compromise was made, that the IRS said, okay, you, if you're not in the business of renting your house, you can rent it out and not have to pay income tax on it. And the definition was, if you rent your house for 14 days or less per year, you are not in the business of renting your house, and all of that income can be tax-free. If you rent it for 15 days or more, you're now in the business of renting real estate, and you have to pay tax on all that income. So guess how many days? So now I need to find a way to rent my personal house for 14 days so I don't have to create income. Well, I don't want strangers in my house, right? So I don't want to go, like, I don't live in a place where strangers would come rent my house. But put a pin in that for a second. Now back over to here. I have a business holding company that needs to hold events for clients.
Okay.
I do. I actually have masterminds that I hold for clients. So now my plumbing company, right? My under your AI company underneath, right? Contracts with my holding company to be my event planner. So now my company's also an event planning company. My holding company is. Okay. And I get to choose the venue. So now I have a business client that needs a venue for an event.
Okay. Yeah.
Guess where I choose to have my events?
Your office.
At my home office.
Your home office. Yeah.
And guess how many of these I do every year?
365.
Nope, 14. Because if I do 15, okay, I have to pay income tax on it.
Okay, okay.
14 of them.
Right.
So I do 14 events in my house, about one a month.
Yes.
And they can be virtual or in person. It doesn't matter. But okay, I need my house for it. So now my business pays me. And there's a wedding venue just down the street from my house. It's like an old farm that's converted. They charge $7,500 a day for that venue. So now I go to the IRS and say, hey, if I didn't use my house, I would have rented that place that charges $7,500. So now my business pays me $7,500 a day for 14 days. Let's do a little bit of math. 7,500 times 14, that's $105,000 a year that my business gets as a business write-off that comes to me personally that I do not have to put on my tax return. That money just literally disappears.
Well, you could say that I would have went to the Ritz-Carlton and got the $20,000 a night room. I mean, like, is there...
You absolutely could. Nope. Ordinary and necessary.
Okay. Ordinary for who? I mean, because that comes down to the come on.
Yep. There's always a reasonableness test, right? So you need to justify it somehow. So no, you could do that, right? I picked something close to where I actually have my events, right? And so I just said, hey, the next best option. You absolutely could say, hey, I was going to do it in Miami at a penthouse overlooking the ocean, right? But then when they come to my house isn't a penthouse on the ocean. And so they might say, well, but you chose a fundamentally different location. Mm. So it should be similar to the location in my house right down, like that works, right? So, you know, I also live by the adage, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered, right? So we pigs get fat. We don't want to go too far. But for me, I get to take that one strategy, if I can justify this for $105,000 at a marginal tax bracket of 40%, that's $40,000 in taxes right there.
How do you prevent yourself from getting slaughtered? How do you know where to draw the line between hog and pig?
This is why I can share all these strategies, but it's a do not try this at home, right? I'm a trained professional, right? And you need somebody that is, again, I have a degree in taxes. I spend time on Wall Street. We've done this. We have a team of professionals.
Oh, you can't tell. You don't live this whatsoever. There's no sense about it. I mean, like I've never talked to anybody who talks about taxes the way that you talked about it. It's like a kid in Disneyland talking about a game, his favorite game, you know?
Seriously, it's like we're beating the master boss level of whatever video game. Like that's all it is. It's fun. So it really is like you need to be aware that the strategies are there so that you know how to use them, but This is definitely not something to just do it yourself, right? On the side, like there's compliance to it. But the great part about it, like you said, is the amount that we can save versus what it costs to implement there's no better return. Like we average a 2 to 5 times return on our clients' money that they pay us just in taxes. Before we even give business advice about growing their business, before we protect them from inflation and future taxes, and before we place their money and generate, you know, double digit plus annual returns in privately held investments. Before all of that, we generated 2 to 5x return just on the tax strategy component.
You got the whole game going, man. It's not just the tax component. You've got the entire financial aspect taken care of for somebody to walk in and be able to have that, like you said, the one problem that can solve all the rest of the problems. You're so like who, I said, not the how.
And so, like I said, the chief wealth officer doesn't exist, except it does. It didn't exist until we created it. That's why we went tip to tail, was we said, how do we simplify for the business owner all of those conversations and align them, right? And we'll either work with your team or replace team members that need to be there to be able to run it. But that's why we go business consulting all the way to investments and the entire part in between, so that just like the marketing side, we handle the wealth side. Like we're the only hire 100% dedicated to making you wealthy. Like you can't say that about anybody else that you pay money to except us.
You get paid on a fraction of what they would save on taxes? What's your payment structure like?
That is a really, really good question. So again, I came from Wall Street. And if you understood what really goes on, I mean, we all know, but like I saw it. So my first actual job was at Goldman Sachs in downtown New York City. I was in their private net worth division. And this speaks to a little bit of how my brain works. I didn't want to be the Wolf of Wall Street trader on the front lines doing all that stuff. I actually asked to be placed in the compliance department. And the reason why is compliance has to approve all trades, all tax strategy, all investment, all business, like everything. So I sort of viewed myself as I wanted to be Edison in the patent office looking at everybody's ideas.
Mm.
But my timing was perfect because I got a job there in the summer of 08. So it was right as, I mean, I was there and 2 weeks later, our building was next to Lehman Brothers that went down. I was standing on the sidewalk as they all filed out with cardboard boxes. Like we were at ground zero for this. So whatever you think happens behind the scenes at Wall Street, it's 100% true. And I've seen it all. Right. So our fees are not structured that way. We're not taking your money. We're not investing. You're not investing in us. You're not giving us. We are training you to do what the wealthy do and setting up the system around you. There's other people that build themselves out as fractional family offices, but they require you to come into their world. And then if you fire them, you lose all of the support and structure. We are implanting a family office into your business. They're your relationships. They're your investments. They're your strategies. It's your documentation. And we're implant. So if I leave or you fire me, you keep all of it. So we're very transparent about our fees. We're not managing your wealth. We're coaching you and your team to run it. So you're directly investing into everything. So we have an upfront consultation to get everything started and built out. And then it's a monthly retainer. So it's very transparent, exactly what you're paying us. And then if on the back end, we participate with you in an invest, I do all the strategies I'm teaching you. I'm making money right alongside you because I'm in the same storage unit investment, you know, if that's right. What we decided we wanted to put your money into, yeah. Right? And if I am the one that brings the storage unit syndication, I may be an owner in that, but I'm getting paid right alongside you. So we're never out of alignment with our clients. We only make money if our services are valuable or we are making money the exact same way we are by holding the same investments.
Right. I mean, come on, you're not actually an owner in the company if you syndicated it. You're the owner of the owner of the owner and you got it fucking.
Yes. Correct. Exactly. Right. And then I'm hiring my kids to help me do whatever I can.
For the mascots on social media. Dude, yeah. I love it, man. Thank you so much for this incredible gold that you delivered here. So it's Brad at
Sovereign Entrepreneur.com.
Two French words you got there. I just had it in my head too. I was so proud of myself, man. I was like, oh, I remember the French words. I'm going to nail it. And I fucked it up. Dude, Brad at Sovereign Entrepreneur.com. Get in touch with the EA. Man, thank you so much for being here. Absolute pleasure.
Hey, like I said, thanks for having me. I get lit up about talking about this. So the fact that you've got a bunch of entrepreneurs who need this, it's an honor to talk about it, open up everybody's eyes, and hopefully help a couple of them out.
opened up our eyes. You did, man. Yeah, seriously. So yeah, fuck. Thank you so much, man. We'll keep in touch. Okay.
Okay. All right, man. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you, man. Bye.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that podcast episode. And if you want to get a free copy of my book, go to kylesbook.com and you can get a copy there. I'll talk with you soon.